More than a means to reconnect with a sundered galaxy, it gave us hope again. Even when we discovered the full scale of the disaster inflicted upon the far reaches of our Imperium, and truly understood the nature of what would come to be called the Cicatrix Maledictum, the very fact that we had proof of his continued presence among us was enough to banish the worst of our despair. In the short term, though, the Astronomicon's recovery only gave us more problems. We had already lost scores of astropaths to the effects of the Great Rift, and many weakened survivors were killed when the great psychic torrent burst back out into the universe. Information on the state of the Imperium was still scanty at best, and it took time for us to gather any data on just what had taken place during our blindness. The more we discovered in those early days, the more we realized just how bad things had become for us. There was no hope of recovering Cadia. Other war zones, such as the great meat grinder of Armageddon, had also passed far beyond our ability to stabilize. The supply of black ships, on which the throne's creaking mechanisms depended, had been critically disrupted both by the turmoil in the warp and Valoris's unilateral co-option of the Sisters of Silence. Survival had been achieved, that was for sure, but it began to look as if we had done nothing much more than that. But then, just days after those events, came the second great turn of fate. The Lord Commander returned at last from the Hidden Throne, ready to resume the work of his great commission. In years to come, that day was marked with nearly as much reverence as the long-established Sanguinala, signaling the very beginning of the Indomitus Crusade and the titanic effort to recover what had been lost. At the time, though, we had little inkling of any of that. Indeed, the entire enterprise was almost derailed before it had even begun. Despite what had taken place on Luna, I had not expected to be a part of any of it. Once again, in a development that perhaps I shouldn't have been surprised by, I was entirely mistaken. I had gone to visit the man who had started it all, Kerepliades, in his Citadel of Dreams. The master of the Adeptus Astrotelepathica dwelt in one of the stranger domains within the palace, a haunt of warp eddies and psi shunts set under a great dome of black glass. Many of those within the structure were blind, a result of the soul binding that scarred all astropaths, and most of the rest were tainted in some way by the wearing effects of the Imperium. Uniquely among the palace's many fortresses, the hundreds of heavily armed guards within Kerepliades' realm were chiefly there to keep an eye on those inside rather than out. As I hurried to meet the master, I could see the toll that had been taken on this enormous and secretive kingdom. Most of the cells were empty. There was blood on every deck, and the sound of repeated screaming could be made out coming from the pit levels below. Those I passed in the narrow turning corridors regarded me with the hostility of the besieged from under heavy cowls. Kerepliades met me in his command nexus, a blister of armor glass and geller shielding placed high up on the north rim of the Scholastia Sicana's curving outer perimeter. Hundreds of scribes, many hard plugged into baroque stations of wheezing complexity, worked away in near silence, their augmetic fingers clattering on rune boards. Black-armored sentinels with beast-snarled face masks prowled across galleries and bridging gantries, watching every move the scribes made, forever poised for the first twitch or spasm of possession. "So here we are again, Chancellor," the old man said dryly. Like all of us, he looked preternaturally decrepit, even more so than he had before. I bowed. "You were right," I told him, "about Cadia. We get signals from it now." He shuddered. "You don't want to know what's in them." We walked across a long curving span that vaulted over lines of scribe pits. "And the Anathema Sicana are back," he croaked, limping and leaning heavily on an iron cane. "They were part of my purview in the old times." "Perhaps you should have fought to keep them," I said. "No doubt, though we struggle to hold on to what we still have, and I am not stupid enough to pick a fight now with Valoris. He shot me a cynical glance. I don't really like to see custodians on the High Council, Tyrann, despite the necessity of it. They have strange ways.
You can talk, I thought.
You've studied the data I sent to you? I asked. I'd kept my promise. I'd made facsimiles of the information Valerian had brought me and distributed it to all those I could still trust on the Council. I had little hope of countermanding Haematalian's cordon openly, but there was still the chance of building a coalition against it. And in any case, it needed to be seen. If the next invasion was coming via those routes, then we were wasting precious time in power plays when we should have been racing to prepare.
I did, and found it most absorbing, Kerepliades answered, leading me to a high curved doorway.
Everything in that place was elliptical and elusive, just like its occupants.
In fact, that's what I wish to speak to you about.
He made a gesture with his bony right hand, and the door swished open. Beyond was another dome, 20 meters high and windowless. A great iron orrery clanked and wheeled inside it, driven by concentric mechanical tracks. The interior of the hemisphere glowed with lumen points and the trails of hololith projections. It was a planetarium of sorts, a mystical representation of physical space, enhanced, I guessed, by psychic augmentation. I barely noticed any of that, though. Waiting for us in the center of that infernal machine was Gilliman, alone and dressed in the ancient robes of his office. Even out of armor, his aura of command was effortlessly and absurdly dominating, and I found myself dropping to one knee before I was even aware of it.
"Chancellor," the Primarch said in acknowledgment, then nodded to Kerepliades, "the Master tells me this thing originated with you."
At first I didn't realize what he meant, but then noticed how the planetarium had been calibrated. The hololithic lines strung out before us looked very similar to those on the image Alea had discovered, and I recognized the 8 nodes surrounding Terra at the center.
I still don't understand it, I said. Not really.
We are no longer blind, Chancellor, said the Primarch. He looked different to how he'd been before. His noble face was heavily lined now, as if rapid aging had somehow taken place. When I'd first encountered him, he had looked like a prince, full of furious energy. Now he had the grizzled aspect of a warrior king, a monarch weighed down with understanding that was no doubt dreadful. These are the 8 cardinal nodes of a warp circlet around Terra. They describe the only channels safely usable for sizable fleet movements at this point in time.
And the enemy plans to use them, I offered, going on what Alea had believed. They will approach through them, strike at us here.
Kerepliades shook his head.
It's too late for that,
he said, flicking a finger at the swirling diagrams circling overhead. One by one, the nodes went out, fading from red to black. 7 were lost immediately. Only 1, the closest of them, remained faintly present.
Those worlds have already been taken, seized from us while we were blinded.
I turned to Lord Gilliman, suddenly anxious.
Then why do they not push on? I said. They're so close, a mere warp stage away. They're looking right down at us. Why do they wait?
Because attack is not their intention, Gilliman replied. He turned away from the orrery and fixed me with those frigid blue eyes, and as ever, I found it almost impossible to return the gaze.
They know I am here. They know what I intend. Now that the Astronomicon burns again, they know I will launch the crusade that will liberate the stars.
Time is of the essence now, for every hour we delay leads to more worlds lost, and yet time is precisely what we do not have.
They're taking those worlds not to use as staging points, but to turn into the bars of our cage, replied Kerepliades. You see what those signals represent. They've done something there, used some device to shatter the warp conduits. Once they control the planets, they're making the ether go dark.
Gilliman looked back up at the wheeling points of light.
Those are not the routes they need to get in, Chancellor, he said.
They are the roots we need to get out. They are throttling us before we can even begin. I suddenly understood it. The demonic attack, it had been to keep our attention here, to make us believe that terror was the target and that the enemy already had the power to assault our walls directly. But they didn't. Not yet. They still feared Gilliman, and now bent all their efforts on keeping him hemmed in, preventing the coming counterstroke that still risked throwing their wider plans awry. "Then what can be done?" I asked, looking from one to the other urgently. "What can be done?" "One world remains," said the Primarch, his face grim. "While it holds out, we have a path to the open galaxy. You see it yourself, Chancellor. That world is Vorlees. When it falls, we are trapped here. The Crusade will be critically delayed, and 1,000 other worlds will fall before we can overcome the barrier."
"Then we must launch, launch everything." I cursed myself then for not doing more. The need had been there for days, but as ever we had been too slow, too cautious.
"It is already too late," said Gilliman, looking at me carefully. "Vorlees cannot hold for long enough, even if we launched our ships this very moment. We know who assails it, and there are no defenses there capable of resisting them. Unless, of course, you know different."
Of course. They knew. They knew about the Chalandian. They knew about everything I had done and were merely waiting for the confession.
"They cannot be enough," I murmured, suddenly realizing what Valerian had traveled into. "They cannot possibly hold." "You would have earned death for your actions, Chancellor, were the Lex still in force," said Gilliman, breaking into that long stride of his and beckoning for me to follow. "But it is not, and the Council itself is now dissolved. There are forces under my command that even the gods remain unaware of, and I am anxious to show what they can do. We depart within the hour. If you still hold my father to be divine, you might pray that your custodians are as proficient as they themselves believe, for they are now the thread on which our fate hangs."
Everything had already been planned. Everything was already in motion. If I had needed any further proof of the Lord Gilliman's power, here it was. And he, Mertalian, had been right to fear his intentions. The Crusade was already underway, and any attempt to frustrate it was now entirely pointless.
"But, Lord, why tell me these things at all?" I asked, scampering to keep up. He never broke stride. I don't think I ever really saw him at rest from that point onwards, for his soul was a soul of fire, voracious and dynamic, and he knew the penalty that would be paid for inaction. I guessed then that even as the Lion's Gate was under attack, he had been planning this response, though I would later discover that he had been formulating the broad strokes of it for very much longer than that. "Our crusades have always required the services of mortals, Chancellor," he said by way of an answer, offering me one of those flinty half-smiles. "I will need a remembrancer for this, just like the old days. Consider yourself fortunate. I choose you."
Chapter 27. Valerian. I had time to reflect on my decision during our travel within the warp. I drove myself hard, aiming to recover my full spectrum of physical movement and banish the last evidence of my injury, but even so there were still moments of unavoidable reflection. I never doubted my choice. That is the surprising thing to me. I never doubted that I had done what I needed to. Everything on Terra prior to the Great Rift had been pushing me away from proximity to the throne. I do not just mean my failure at the threshold, which was the most dramatic manifestation, but also the increasing distance I had felt from the sanctum itself, from its laws and its history and its rituals. Heraclian told me my name had figured in dreams. I had no reason to doubt that now, but I and he could have been mistaken about what it meant, just as Tyrion had said. To leave was a kind of madness, perhaps. But the sages of our species have always known that truth and madness are close relations. I never regretted what I did then, even though I remained certain that it would be the end of my mortal existence. My brothers of the chamber came with me out of duty, and did not share my vision. I gave them the choice to remain on the walls, but they were content to take my command. As Alea would remind me many times afterwards, our breed were not given to flights of imagination. We required a clear sense of purpose, of rightness, and only within those strictures did we aspire to the status of demigods. I no longer think of that limitation as weakness, even though I suspect she does. We are what we are, the guardians of the flame, not its kindlers. The journey was as difficult as I expected. The Astronomicon remained dark, and our navigator struggled to make good headway. The span was short, such that in ordinary times even the lowliest of their breed could have made it in a single stage, but we were forced to drop into real space frequently to gain our bearings and make complex triangulations with both the physical stars and the arcane map references we still retained. I demanded much from them, just as I did from myself. One of the mutants sickened badly, and for a while his life was in the balance. I made him work. I took no pleasure in that, but the need for progress was acute. You might ask what I expected to achieve by this. For Alea, the answer was obvious: revenge for the wrongs done to her. Even if she did not meet the ones responsible for the destruction of her home, she would encounter those of the same legion, and that was enough. I had no desire for vengeance, though, and never have done. With me, the motivations were threefold. I have already alluded to the sense of rightness that I felt when considering this course of action, knowing that it formed an argument in the long debate about where our best place was within a galaxy of eternal war. Second, there was the debt of honour I had made to Alea, who now had taken this concept up with some enthusiasm, reminding me often, I think in jest, that she had saved my life and thus had me under her obligation. And there was a third consideration. I remembered how I had felt on that battlefield after the destruction of the greater demon, a feat far outranking any I had achieved before. I remember how much I had wanted that feeling to continue. I could no longer deny it to myself. The exercise of arms had become more than an intellectual pursuit, one conducted only in the furtherance of my sacred duty. I heard the old complaints made against us, that we had never experienced the war as others had, and for the first time the barbs found some purchase. For all our valour in the hidden conflicts we had always conducted, it had taken the demon army arriving on Terra to remind us what we had once dared to measure ourselves against. So the moral imperative was there. The great heretic philosopher of M2, Emmanuel Kant, had said that one should act only on that maxim that one could also wish to be a universal law, a credo I had never fully understood before. Now I believed I perceived the truth of it, even in an age when all laws were eroding before our eyes, and the full spectrum of morality had been subsumed into the moribund category of duty. Forgive these rambling thoughts. I warned you of my penchant for theology. The short answer is, of course, that I have no short answer. I only have the dictates of my soul, of which I remain certain. Alea thinks little of such speculation. You talk too much, she signed to me once. Not something anyone could accuse you of, I replied. We broke the veil as close as we dared, knowing that speed would be of the essence. I had my armor lifted into place. I donned my helm and took Gnosis into my fist once more. The weight of it was an assurance. My brothers did the same, as did the anathema Psychana. There were more of them than us, and their weaponry was more varied. Whereas we carried guardian spears only, they bore flamers, great blades, even chainswords. A little over 40 of us then, to contest the conquest of a world. We could not be faltered for our ambition. As the Chalandian accelerated, I studied images of our inward attack run on the bridge-mounted image banks. Once past the Mandeville threshold, we powered swiftly towards the system center. For a long while, there was no sign of any other ship. This was not surprising. With the collapse of the Astronomicon's beacon, we assumed that warp travel had all but dried up across the Imperium, leaving our space lanes empty. Only when we came within visual range of the planet itself, a sapphire and pink orb of considerable beauty, did evidence of the enemy become apparent. There was a single battleship in low orbit, surrounded by shoals of lesser craft and a huge cloud of floating debris. I recognized the profile of the master vessel immediately, an Executor-class Grand Cruiser, looming in gigantic splendor, though twisted and changed by its time spent in the eye. Its vast flanks were black, ridged with brass, bearing the octet on heavily oxidized ablative plating. Any Imperial craft had been reduced to components in that debris cloud. Aside from a phalanx of escorts, the remaining vessels looked to be landers descending on the world below in steady procession. "So you were right," I told Alea, sitting opposite me in the lander's crew bay. We had no chance of engaging it directly and surviving. Even alone, an Executor was virtually a line battleship, built to survive void war encounters against whole squadrons of destroyers, and the Chalandian was both outpowered and outgunned. We had expected that, however, and our attack plan did not alter.
"Signs of heavy assault on world," came the clipped voice of my master of sensors, an indentured menial of our service with shaved head and eagle sigil tabard. "Fighting detected across northern continental mass. Considerable destruction. Orbital defenses in ruins. 70 conflict sites identified by Augur. More coming in."
The escorts had already locked onto us. The Executor was beginning to turn, and I watched its forward lance begin to churn with a clot of blood-red energies. "Good," I said, studying the schematics of the ongoing invasion. "Less of them to encounter on board. Enact attack run, as outlined. Keep us alive for just a little while." We ramped up speed, and the plasma drives thundered. Across short distances, I judged we had the advantage. Our engines were far more advanced than the colossal powertrains employed on those behemoths, even if that edge would likely only prove temporary. We took hits from the escorts, black-hulled close attack craft with spiked ventral ridges and close-packed lasfire arrays. Macro-cannon batteries began to flicker as the cruiser wallowed into closer range, sending hailstorms of shells fizzing past us. I departed the command dais. Alea came with me, and we joined the others on a heavy platform set back from the main arch of the bridge. The deck rocked beneath us as we were hit again, the impact stressing our forward void shielding and making the real viewers crackle. We ignored the lesser craft, speeding through their cordon and absorbing their punishment. The Chalandian powered straight towards the Executor, and soon I could begin to make out the detailing across the cruiser's ancient lines. Everything had been mangled, tortured, flexed into colonnades of grotesquerie. Every gun barrel was a gaping maw. Every hull plate was disfigured with hammered-out eyes or claws or teeth. The black mass of its hide was mottled, as though covered in a patina, the accumulation of centuries plying corrupted depths. Even its void movements were sinister, as if crabbed by the laws of physics, it suddenly and unwillingly had to obey.
"The Black Legion," Alea signed.
I looked at her. Her face was already twisted into hatred, an expression only part hidden by her mask. "We will be among them soon enough," I said. The volume of fire picked up. The Chalandian shuddered, hit again by a brace of well-aimed shots. I saw warnings flash up on the status of our void shields. For the time being, we had evaded the great lance weapons, but the Executor itself now swelled hugely, filling up the forward auger lenses like a cliff face of burnished metal. We fired back, a single shot, concentrated on a single location, high up on the cruiser's bridge level. The technology behind that beam was far beyond anything possessed by either the enemy or our own regular armies, and a blue-white column of searing energy pierced straight through the cruiser shielding, blowing a ragged hole amid an explosion of released static. It was all we needed. "Now!" I commanded. The teleport chamber blazed into cold life, flooding all of us in columns of spitting witchlight.
For a split second, we were nowhere, ripped from the heart of the engagement and flung into the netherworld of the warp. I heard a sound like rushing water, booming in my ears, covering an undertow that might have been screams. Then the world of the sensors crashed back into solidity around us. We rematerialized within the cruiser's bowels. The walls were concave and serrated, as if we were in some immense black ribcage, and spiked columns soared up towards a many-tiered hammer-beam roof hanging with stalactites of iron. The metal was dank, glistening with condensation, and the inner atmosphere was as hot as a furnace. Sparse red lumens barely broke through a thick miasma that swayed and undulated with something like sentience. I could smell a range of overlapping aromas. Hot metal, old blood, the rotten fruit stench of primordial corruption. My helm cogitator immediately scanned through the decks, giving me a three-dimensional schema to navigate by. I could already hear brazen warhorns sounding in the depths. The distant report of cannon fire continued, indicating that the Chelandian still lived. With the Emperor's blessing, it had hopefully now pulled clear again and run for sanctuary further out. But we had passed close by on that infiltration run, and the ship had no doubt taken heavy damage. One reading on that schema made no sense to me. It was as if the scans dropped off a cliff when trying to probe a whole section of the lower hull. Something huge was masked, cut out as if physically excised. Instinct told me that that was what we had come for, and I gave the order. We moved out, our weapons glittering in the darkness, only to find the enemy coming for us. They had reacted with predictable speed, charging down the ship's clanging corridors to engage the boarders in their midst. They were legionaries, for the most part, lumbering out of every corridor mouth in a thudding chorus of heavy bootfalls, bolters booming, chain blades revving, vox augmitters roaring. Their black lacquered armor glinted, a livery that sucked the meager light into itself, as if famished for it. We swept into close combat, Custodian and Anathema Sicana against heretic Legiones Astartes. My spear hurtled, trailing golden paths within the miasma. I saw Alea tearing into them, kicking out with her armored boot, even as her blade danced. The sisters had no demonic aura to contest here, and so fought just as we did, warriors tempered in the furnace of physical conditioning, immune to fear, faster and stronger than all but the mightiest of our peers in the Emperor's service. But the foes we faced were nigh as deadly. The rawest of them were hundreds of years old, the first among those who had marched with the Warmaster in the Lost Age, steeped in the cruel tutelage of the Eye, and now advancing under the Despoiler's colours. They had been bloated, changed and ravaged by the gifts of their gods, made both stronger and wilder, the heralds of a new age of ruin. This was their place, and they crashed through the clouds of vapour with a swagger of assurance. I slammed into the first of them, a thick-set champion with a tusked and bloated death mask, his lenses as red as coals, and his armour draped with sheets of flayed hide. He punched his chainblade into me, and Gnosis met the lunge halfway, turning it back before the energy fields exploded in snarls of flame. I lashed out with my gauntlet, cracking into his gorget seal, then switched my blade back to drive it under his breastplate. He was fast, and he was strong, but I had ended many of his kind in hundreds of blood games. I knew the way they fought, I knew their doctrines and their habits, and so I thrust a final time, propelling Gnosis up into his lungs and ripping through the power pack beyond. The reactor cells, warped and corroded as they were, imploded noisily, burning him from the inside. I cast his spasming body aside and advanced further, fighting my way out of the hall and into the warrens beyond. My brothers came with me, as did the Anathema Sicana. Every step became bloody and laboured. The oncoming legionnaires clogged the narrow corridors, barreling into us and dogging our movements. I felt my muscles burn, my auramite flex under the blows, my spear shiver at every impact. The sisters slew with hatred in their eyes. Their speed and force came from anger now, just as it had done on Terra. They were giving themselves no quarter, risking all just for the chance to hurt those who would hurt them. In such confined spaces they were formidable, almost elemental, able to use their lighter frames to race into gaps and pull away from danger. We were different. We fought as we had always fought, methodically, precisely, falling into the numerology of the near future and racing ahead of mortal thought. These warriors were used to slaughter, either in the eye against their own kind, or against the mortal defenders of his realm. But we had been made to hunt them. That was perhaps the darkest of the many secrets we carried, that from the very beginning, from even before the Great Crusade itself, we had been prepared for this and engineered to surpass them. To the galaxy at large, these warriors were the greatest of his created weapons, the apogee of his martial genius. We considered them only as our natural prey. So I laid them low. I tore through them and ripped them apart. I cracked their armor open, and I pulled their flesh into ribbons. My brothers did the same, working in perfect silence, each consumed with his own study of murder. The legionnaires cursed us in tongues long dead, repeating mockery that had been old even at the time of the siege. But we made no response, and their fell weapons ground up against our shimmering Auramite blades in cascades of thrown disruptor light. More were arriving all the time to repel us, coagulating like cells in a bloodstream. I guessed that even greater numbers were being summoned back from the surface. There might already have been hundreds on that ship, and after a certain point, those numbers would tell. But not yet. I had the signal on my auger, and it drove me onwards. Deck by deck, corridor by gore-drenched corridor, we burned our way towards the goal. That was the only thing that existed for us then. We were lost in that cloying dark, burrowing even deeper, going so far that soon light itself became a memory. I felt the entire structure close in around me, sensed the malign resonance of its tons and tons of corrupted metalwork, its ancient devices, and its warp-infused chambers, and for a brief heretical moment was reminded of that other catacomb, the one where I had been repelled. But there was no threshold that could bar me here. I was out, I was free, and now vengeance slavered at my heels.
Chapter 28. Alea. I let Valerian guide our path within that ship. All I wished to do there was cause as much damage as possible. We took losses from the very beginning. The first of our number fell in that rib-sparred hall, caught by heavy bolter fire, and sent spinning into the murk. Even once we gained the corridors, we were hard hit, for those enemies were relentless. They stank of blood, and they were brutally hard to down. If we had not had the custodians with us, we would have fared much worse, but even they were tested by what they fought. It mattered little, for I had what I wished for in those moments. I could look my foe in the eye and test my blade against his. There were no duels of honour in that desperate struggle, as there might have been in another age, for we only desired to inflict hurt. We ganged up on them, swamping them in those tight claustrophobic corridors, before taking them apart in combined enactments of revenge. Our relative lack of bulk was even an advantage then, as we could crowd in close, cutting at their airways and smashing their eye lenses. The custodians set a punishing pace, and soon we were delving deeper, forging a path down into the engine levels, where heavy machinery thrummed and yammered. The entire ship was a haunt of semi-fused shedim, locked into the molten metal and spitting blasphemies at us as we ran. When I could, I shattered those fixtures, enjoying the shrieks as we cleaved demon iron from its mounting. I had no concern for my own safety, for I knew well enough we would die in that place. But every corpse we created still felt like a benediction, an offering on the altar of our long suffering. I thought of my sisters on Eraser when I killed. With every life I ended, I signed another name, matching the corpses to those who I still remembered. Eventually we neared the very base of that huge vessel, down in the ballast stumps where the air was thick with carbon dioxide, and the decking throbbed with engineering heat. Our band had dwindled under the constant counter-assault, and even one of Valerian's chamber had been killed at last, his head smashed in by a power-fisted brute with a demon blade. The rest fought on after that without the merest change in demeanour, Their blows remained just as metronomically perfect, neither faster nor slower, an exactitude of tick-tock slaughter. It was only as we neared our destination, the place that Valerian had selected as the one where we would make our stand, that I felt something nag at me. A noumenal drag, like a sudden flex of high grav slinking through the mire of semi-light. The corridors slipped by in a blurred orgy of close-packed carnage, and the drag became more pronounced until I felt like I was heading into something at once totally new and also horribly familiar. We finally fought our way into a high chamber with a heavy pair of saw-toothed blast doors on the far side. Valerian dismantled a legionnaire guard single-handed, spinning bodily into him before breaking his neck, while we jointly took care of the rest. Then we laid charges against the doorway, dozens of them, and blew it into sprayed fragments. On the far side, a great cylindrical well gaped ahead of us, a circular shaft that disappeared into the body of the vessel above us and out through the lower hull below. The volume of it was colossal, over 100 meters in diameter and far higher. When I looked down, I could see straight out into the void, and the shining disk of Orlese's upper atmosphere glared back at us from behind a glitter of void shielding. Electric force snaked up and down the shaft, catching on feeder vanes jutting out at regular intervals. For a moment, I was seized with a powerful lurch of vertigo, realizing that we had raced onto a precipice over the infinite. I looked up. Something vast was suspended above us, held tight by massive chains the diameter of rhino transports. It was truly gigantic, a long shard of black stone that led right back into the heart of the ship, faceted like a crystal, humming and yanking against its bonds. At first I didn't understand what it was, only that it was so big that half the entire cruiser must have been hollowed out in order to carry it. Then I suddenly knew why I felt the way I did. Perhaps no other mortal would have experienced quite the same sensation, for that thing, that immense rod of dark stone, was the same as I was. It was a null, a blank, a sink and dissipator of psychic force. I was a lone individual capable of projecting my unique repellence only a few meters. This thing must have had the power to deny the warp over a vast range. I didn't fully understand what purpose that could serve, but I could begin to make a guess. This ship had come halfway across the galaxy, bearing this null cargo, retrofitted purely in order to carry it, racing far ahead of the great armies of the Despoiler, in order to bring it into position here. From the gap in the cruiser's hull, I could even see the carnage wrought below us on the planet's surface. A vast scar cut into the pristine terrain, hundreds of square kilometers burned and secured in preparation for what was to come. It would launch. The shard would be hurled down at the world below, and when it did, this system would go dark. Already I could sense an enormous build-up of power around us and saw red marker lights race down the long shaft to the aperture at the hull's edge. "The chains!" I signed frantically, seeing that the great fixings where the shackles met the inner wall would soon blow, loosing the shard to plunge planetwards. The concave surface of the shaft was riddled with stairways and access platforms, latticing the walls all the way up. Above us was the first of many anchor points for the chains, swollen into a huge bulkhead that jutted far out into the emptiness. I raced up the nearest stairwell, a rust-thick ladder that wound its way up within a metal cage, Reaver hard on my heels. Just as I got close to the summit, the first bolt of fire ricocheted in, smashing through the rotting steelwork and smacking hard into the wall sections beyond. More shots rained down, and I glimpsed legionnaires emerging from access points above us, below us, across the far side of the shaft. Motorized gantries began to creak across the gulf, ready to link the two sides up, and more kill squads clattered across them, poised to throw themselves right into us. I kept going, slipping and stumbling, my hands struggling to grip the rungs as the bolt shells ripped past. We were horribly exposed, open to ranged fire, and once the gantries slammed home, the enemy would be free to assault directly. There was almost no cover, just the webs of scaffolding and access ladders, which would do little against fury such as theirs. I reached the bulkhead, hauled myself through a wide access port, and heaved up onto its summit, a flat plain of weathered adamantium, no more than 10 meters across. Before me stood the chain's anchorage, a swollen tangle of rockcrete the size of a land raider, that pinned the first of those enormous, great links to the inner wall of the shaft. Reva emerged beside me, racing across the bulkhead's perimeter, firing all the time from her bolt pistol. I took the last of my melter charges and slammed them against the mooring's bolt mechanism, even as the warning klaxon sounded for its release. Then I was hit on the shoulder, thrown to the floor and dragged along by the momentum. I had a brief impression of the whirling abyss below, and saw the bright disk of Vorlees blurry at the bottom of the shaft, before a firm gauntlet seized me and hauled me back. I found myself staring up at Valerian's helm for a brief moment. Then he vaulted past, firing bolts from his guardian spear and shielding me from further hits. My melter charges blew in sequence, fusing the massive links to their housing in a sequential burst of roaring plasma. Runes flashing over the arcane machinery suddenly flicked to red, and the heavy chain went taut, kicking out sparks and shaking the entire bulkhead platform. By then, others of us had made it to the same vantage, and we clustered there together, custodians and sisters alike, firing into the oncoming legionnaires, and using what scant cover we could to shield ourselves from the storm of incoming shells. From below, from where we had emerged, I heard the clang of fresh fighting breaking out. 8 of my sisters and 2 of Valerian's chamber had remained behind to hold the doorway, and now fought back desperately against the charge from the corridors beyond. More projectiles thudded into the metalwork around us, detonating in splinter bursts and punching clouds of powderized rockcrete high into the air. I crouched down, keeping my blade in one hand while I reached for my pistol. Valerian stood beside me then, his heavier armor absorbing hits that would have pulverized mine. Even as I opened fire, I could hear the muffled cries of my sisters as they were cut down one by one, the only sound that had passed their lips since the vow. I saw a custodian hammered back by a whole welter of heavy impacts, his battle plate bludgeoned into bloody craters, and his spear shattered. The chain still held taut. For as long as we held that bulwark, the shard could not release. I watched the tortured links stretch and spark afresh, straining against the melted armature and opening cracks up in the rockcrete. The mooring locked fast. It would need to be cut loose at close range now before they could complete the launch, and our enemy knew it. I pushed my back into the charred mass of melted ironwork, firing steadily at the legionnaires who trundled to engage us. We were sitting targets where we were, hemmed in against the bulkhead's outcrop, our ammunition running down rapidly, and our armor already dinked and scored. There were so many of them now, pouring out of every opening, their red lenses glowing amid dark helms, their cursed language echoing against the soaring adamantium walls. The first of them reached the end of the looming gantries and leapt in among us. Valerian met him with his spear, slicing him almost clean in two, then kicking him over the edge. More piled in after that, and I switched back to hauling my blade two-handed. We were dying. There were fewer than 20 of us left by then, clustered around that burned-out mooring, our backs to one another and fighting hard. Dozens more legionnaires crashed down from the fully extended gantries, and beyond them came dozens more. The tide was never ending, a storm surge that would overwhelm us sooner or later, no matter how many of them we slew first. And then came the strangest thing of all. As I swung my great blade to meet the next challenge, I heard Valerian chuckling softly. He had already dispatched another legionnaire and was wading straight into another. I had never heard him laugh before. Even as I locked blades with my own enemy, I found the whole thing strikingly surreal. "Hold fast, Anathema," he told me, his spear whirling around him in those glorious golden parabolas. "This is where it ends. Let us make it a stand for the ages." He was elated. I could hear the battle joy in his voice. Everything I had thought about him was wrong, it turned out. He was capable of moving beyond himself, of escaping that infernal tomb on Terra, and becoming so much more. This was a new age, I thought then. We had lived to see it dawn, and had fought for its survival. Death in that cause was not a tragedy. It was a privilege. So I spoke. I did it. What use were vows then? They had never helped me before. "By his will alone," I said out loud, fighting hard, relishing my final words as they slipped from my lips.
Chapter 29. Tyran. Let me tell you what manner of commander the Imperium now had. The safest course of action, once we had burned through the warp into the Vorlees system, would have been to destroy the enemy fleet instantly. We had the guns for it, and we knew what its purpose was. As we emerged into orbit and saw that ruinous squadron at geostation over the cleared site below, I fully expected the lances to be ignited. That's not what he did, though. "If they live yet, they deserve more than martyrdom," he said, making ready to lead the first of many boarding parties into the Grand Cruiser. And so he went into combat himself, a Primarch leading his own force of Space Marines, the like and profile of which I had never seen before. Our battleships scattered the enemy escorts and zeroed their mighty cannons onto the main prize. Once the Grand Cruiser's shields were crippled, hundreds of them teleported into contact, sweeping through that corrupt old hulk like a storm wind, and scouring it down to the metal. Their orders were to seize the vessel and retrieve any of our own who still survived within it. I understood then why so many would follow this leader. You may have heard of his reputation for calculation and cold strategic mastery. But that only tells part of the story. In an inhumane age, he reminded us what we had lost. I was permitted to take a shuttle over once the enemy ship had been secured and the worst of the fighting was done. I never wished to find myself in such a place again. Every rivet of it was sickening, resonant with the same latent horror that the demons had brought to us on Terra. I had to cover my mouth as I was escorted down through those dark, humid corridors, choosing not to look into the many chambers that we passed, lest I see something that would turn my mind. Gilliman wanted me to see the site of the final battle for myself. He wanted me to see the great shaft and the remnants of that pylon hanging from its heavy chains, just so it would be clear how close we had come. Had the device been deployed, warp transit through the Vorlees node would have been impossible, crippling the crusade before it could have begun, and delaying it for years. At that stage, we did not fully understand how they were able to do it, and the shard's origins would only be discovered later. For eons, it turned out, these objects had been embedded in the soils of Cadia, part of a poorly understood network that had held the gate open since time immemorial. The Despoiler's seizure of that world had finally destroyed its great pylons, allowing the Eye to spill at last from its boundaries and infect half the galaxy. Only splinters of those original sentinels were recovered, mere fragments of the occult nexus that had once existed to hem the tides back. They were taken from Cadia, tempered on dark forges, bound by fell sorceries, and augmented in blood-soaked rites, until their original power was twisted into that of pure ether destruction. Just one such shard was now capable of extinguishing the warp's touch from an entire planetary system. And if that system lay at the center of a warp conduit, then the conduit was lost too. There was a dark irony to that. For so long we had benefited from the esoteric properties of the Cadian pylons to keep our enemies restricted. Now, having burst his bonds, the despoiler had turned the wreckage of his old cage into weapons. Of course, back then, I knew nothing of that, and assumed we had merely stumbled on some arcane instrument of unknown provenance. As I gazed up the mighty well, towards the suspended splinter of dark stone, though, I could sense the wrongness of it, as if it was sucking all life and hope into itself. I remembered how I had felt when a layer had first been brought to me, and perceived the resemblance. I do not truly understand that repulsion, even now. The warp was the source of so much anguish for us, and yet its absence generated perhaps the greatest abhorrence of all. I suppose that is the tragedy of our kind. We are like moths to the candle, bound inextricably to the thing that destroys us. I see no solution to that riddle, and wonder if he ever truly did either. Perhaps the custodians know more than we do. If so, of course, they would never speak of it. They have changed in some ways, but many things remain the same. I did not expect to lay eyes on Valerian again. In the event, though, I was surprised. He lived, as did two others, including the anathema Sykana, who had come with him to see me. The captain of Gilliman's Space Marines told me that they had been discovered still standing, their bodies run through with wounds, their armor shattered, but they were still fighting. By the time I arrived at the site, perched high up inside the curving wall of that abyss, the Medicaid teams were already taking them away. The piles of bodies around the bulkhead and the smashed ruins of the rockcrete beyond were testament to their extraordinary resilience. I could not share any words with him, though. He was unconscious, his ravaged face hidden behind a rebreather, and his broken limbs covered in metal struts. His black cloak had been burned away, leaving him only with his battle plate of gold. Even in that comatose state, I thought how much more of a warrior that made him look. Less of a hieratic guardian of the palace, more like the Adeptus Astartes. Perhaps they would do away with those black robes now. I think they'd earned the right to cast them off. The Sister of Silence was similarly wounded, as was the one other living custodian. They were all borne away reverently, and as they were taken, the power in the cylindrical chamber was finally drained down, ending the threat that the shard posed. Their true victory had been more profound than that, however, for it was clear that no others could have hoped to have held that ground for so long under such sustained attack. More eloquently than any argument in the council, that defiance had made the case, and against all my pessimism, the effects of dissolution came about in the end. In council, they would call it the Vorlees precedent. The principle of deploying the custodian guard for those rare actions where their unique talents could best be employed and where no others could serve. They like to give these things such names. It makes them feel, I suppose, that they still have control. The wider battle was not yet over, of course. Hard fighting lay ahead to recover the planet below and secure it against further assault. The enemy had stretched himself to the limit to strike at us so close that we could not be sure that another host would not come on the heels of the first, and so Gilliman ordered a steady stream of reinforcements to join us over the coming days. Vorlees would be made into a fortress, one through which hundreds of warships would soon pass. We had lost one great sentinel world. Soon another would rise to take its place. I observed what I could of those preparations, unsure exactly of how old remembrances had done things, and feeling far too old to be a good example of the breed. In my mind's eye, the great chroniclers of the past had always been younger, full of a dynamism that I had never really possessed. By the time we broke the veil back to Terra, however,
I had data slates full of material, all of which I diligently compiled into my account and placed in the archives. This is what you are hearing now, of course, supplemented by the oral testimony of others. I trust that it will be found useful, even as the Indomitus Crusade burns its way through the stars and war kindles like never before. So much relies on this, and our survival as a species still hangs in the balance. I do not truly know whether Gilliman is the savior many think him to be, but I remain uniquely fortunate to have met him, even for that briefest of times. In the event, that short excursion was my one and only experience of such service. I was not strong enough for the rigors of a full-scale campaign, and respectfully declined the offer of a second posting as Remembrancer. Terra was, and always had been, my true home, for all its insanity and degradation. More than that, though, I realized I had been distracted by all this for too long, lost in my old roles, but without my old powers. All things change, and all things fade, and to fight against the waning of that light would have been hubris, not defiance. The Council of High Lords would remain in place, albeit with somewhat altered personnel and much reduced power, and someone needed to massage their egos and corral them into line. Not me, you understand. The new Cancellarius, as you will no doubt know, was Jack, and I could not have thought of anyone more suited to the task. I flatter myself she had had a first-class tutelage, though I suspect that in due course she will leave me far behind. In the interim, I offer what advice I can, hoping I do not overstep my bounds, and am spending more and more time with the collections of finery in my chambers. They allowed me to keep that room as it was, and I find the artifacts a comfort. I made it to exhibit the best of us, and I would not want some officious scholiast breaking it up and sending the vases to the furnace. I feel age creeping up on me now. I will not undergo yet more rejuve treatments, for I suspect that this galaxy is becoming something I will not recognize soon. Darker years lie ahead, just as they always have, and stronger souls will be needed to face them. But I was blessed to witness those days, despite their horror. I was blessed to see the Primarch return, and the Adeptus Custodes rise up from their long vigil to bring vengeance to the far reaches of the galaxy. For so long I had doubted my worth, never shaking off the faint drag of shame that had dogged me since childhood. But I could look back now on my part in that great change, and feel some satisfaction. They would make a difference now. Valerian is among them, I believe, as is Alea. Somewhere out there in the void they are slaying, he with equanimity, she with that ever-burning anger. Perhaps they even serve together. I hope I will see them again before the end, though I am reconciled to the fact that I will probably not. Things will unfold as they will. Experience has made me more accepting of that. I no longer entertain the darkest of thoughts. I have learned, I think, to trust a little more. I have learned to let things go. Most of all, I no longer doubt. That was Watchers of the Throne, The Emperor's Legion, by Chris Raitt. Read by Gareth Armstrong, John Banks, and Emma Gregory. This recording is copyrighted to Games Workshop 2017.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.